Good day. Today is Sunday, 26th October 2025. And before I proceed with the substance of the video, let me again first remind you that to tick the like button if once you've watched the video or that part of the video you want to watch, you like what you've seen and heard, and decide that you want to indicate that fact by ticking the like button. Anyway, let's proceed now with the substance of the programme. And, well, the first thing to discuss, it seems to me, has to be the latest reports from the military, from the military situation in Ukraine. And it seems that yesterday, Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, we're told that he visited a command position of the Russian military somewhere in the area of the special military operation. I'm going to make a guess that it was probably in the Pokrovsk area. And there he heard a report from the chief of the general staff, General Gerasimov, and that was followed up apparently by further reports from various battlefield commanders. Now, as I said, I suspect that this meeting took place somewhere in the general area of Pokrovsk, perhaps in Selidovo, a town that the Russians captured last year, and which some reports say has been used by the Russians as their base centre for the forces, the Russian forces, that are currently engaged in military operations in Pokrovsk. The reason I think it might have been in the Pokrovsk area rather than somewhere else is that the Russian Defense Ministry itself told us the day before that General Gerasimov himself had come to the Pokrovsk area and had heard reports from the military unit commanders of the fighting involved in the area of Pokrovsk. So if Gerasimov was there, and if Putin heard a report from Gerasimov, it seems logical to place both of these people in the same location that the Defense Ministry tells us Gerasimov was, which is in the general area of Pokrovsk. This is purely a guess, but if I'm right, it would be the closest that Putin has come, to my knowledge, to the actual combat line. Anyway, let's proceed with Gerasimov's report, which is momentous and which confirms points which have been made on this program and on the Duran in recent programs, which is that we are looking at two encirclements, at least two encirclements underway, two cauldrons underway, one in Pokrovsk, perhaps the more important one in some respects, the second one in Kupiansk. Gerasimov and the military commanders apparently confirmed this fact to Putin and provided Putin with details. Now, before I proceed to discuss what Gerasimov himself said, let me reiterate a further point, which is that this, again, represents a continuation of the new pattern of Russian disclosures about information on the battlefronts. Until a few months ago, the practice of the Russian Defense Ministry was to say very little, to provide just brief reports telling us where fighting was taking place. Occasionally they would say that such and such a place had been captured or liberated, as they prefer to say, and to provide details of combat losses that they alleged that they had inflicted on the Ukrainian side. Only after battles were concluded would the Defense Ministry release a more detailed update. Sometimes, by the way, in the form of a meeting between the Russian Defense Minister, for most of this war, General Shoigu, and Putin, as happened following the falls of Mariupol and Avdiivka. But on other occasions, a more detailed report that was provided by the Defence Ministry itself on its website. This time, for the last couple of months, as Russian advances on the front lines have quickened, and that's a controversial statement, which I get to come to later in the programme. As Russian advances have quickened and as Russian confidence has grown, they've started to provide us with running commentaries on the progress of ongoing battles. And Gerasimov himself has provided more detailed briefings about the state of the battles to Putin and to the Defence Minister Andrei Belousov, which we've had details of, which have been publicised by the Russian Defence Ministry, and of which this latest report by Gerasimov to Putin is a further example, and which has also been published in the form of a transcript of the introductory words provided by the Kremlin itself. Anyway, let's now go straight to what Gerasimov said, and skipping a few preliminary words, Gerasimov said this: "The joint force troops continue to carry out their assigned tasks to liberate the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, as well as Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, in accordance with the objectives set for the special military operation." Now, notice immediately that these words refer to ongoing Russian military operations to carry out assigned tasks to liberate Donetsk and Luhansk regions. Well, that is not controversial, but also Zaporozhye and Kherson regions as well. Over the last couple of months, ever since Putin met Witkoff in the summer, on the eve of the Alaska summit, there's been a chatter of commentary that the Russians offered a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, provided the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass, from Donetsk and Luhansk regions. Well, no hint of anything like that here. According to Gerasimov, the Russian military have been assigned the task to liberate Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, and that is what they are continuing to do. There is no hint here of any preparation, of any move towards a ceasefire. Well, perhaps we should not expect a discussion of what would be ultimately a political decision in Gerasimov's report, but anyway, I just thought I would mention it. And then we get to the heart of the issue. Today, I would like to elaborate on two directions, the one being the area of responsibility of Group of Forces Centre. Formations and military units of the 2nd and 51st Armies, advancing along converging axes, have completed the encirclement of the enemy in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd areas. Now, he doesn't say Pokrovsk and Mirnograd areas, he says Krasnoarmeysk and Dmitrov areas. Krasnoarmeysk is the name the Russians use to refer to Pokrovsk, and Dmitrov is the name the Russians use to refer to Mirnograd. These are the Soviet names of these places. Pokrovsk and Mirnograd are the Ukrainian names. The Russians have officially stuck with the Soviet names, simply in order to avoid confusion. I will continue to use the Ukrainian names, Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. But just to reiterate again, those are not the names that Gerasimov himself uses in his report. And then he goes on to say this: "A large group of Ukrainian troops comprising 31 battalions was blocked, including units from the 25th, Airborne, 79th Airborne Assault and 68th Jaeger Brigades, as well as the 35th and 38th Marine Brigades, the 425th Separate Assault Regiment, and the 153rd and 155th Mechanized Brigades. Now, these are some of the elite units of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, just to say. Though, notice that he's talking about 31 battalions in total, and it is likely that the bulk of these battalions are from much more low-grade units, maybe units of the territorial forces that are the conscripted forces that the Ukrainians have been building up since the start of the conflict in 2022. Anyway, 31 battalions. Now, Putin's spokesman, press spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that the number of Ukrainian troops encircled in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, and notice that Gerasimov says that these troops are now indeed encircled. But he said, but Peskov says that the totality of the troops encircled in Mirnograd and Pokrovsk comes to 5,500 men. Now, Gerasimov talks about 31 battalions. A battalion, a Ukrainian battalion, would number between 300 and 500 men. So that gives one a sense of the extent to which military units in Ukraine, in the Ukrainian army, have become severely depleted. Because 31 battalions would normally number between, well, 15, between 10 and 15,000 men, something along that, something of that kind of scale. But Peskov says it's only 5,500. Of course, I don't know that it is even that number. I am not there. I'm not able to check or count up Peskov's numbers. He might be overstating things hugely. He may be getting this completely wrong. But the Russians say that 5,500 Ukrainian troops are trapped, are encircled by the Russians in Pokrovsk. Anyway, Gerasimov then commends the various Russian military units that have conducted this particular operation. I noticed that amongst them, the Rubicon Group, which of course is the group that operates the drones, gets mentioned. And then Gerasimov goes on to say, the success of the operation to encircle the enemy was supported by comprehensive fire damage on Ukrainian military formations across the entire depths of their operational deployment, as well as isolating the combat zone to disrupt the enemy's supply lines. At the present time, the group of centres' priority is the equally important task of destroying the encircled Ukrainian group in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd agglomeration. Now, this, again, is to some extent different, because up to now, usually, in most battles, there have been exceptions, but in most battles, the Russians have allowed an avenue for Ukrainian troops who have been mostly encircled to escape. This has been done principally in order to make it easier to capture the place where the Ukrainian troops were located, in order to limit Russian casualties and to end the battle more quickly. Gerasimov says this time the objective is to destroy the encircled Ukrainian group in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. So it looks as if the Russians this time are aiming in fact, prioritizing, Gerasimov said, used the word priority, prioritizing the destruction, the complete destruction of the Ukrainian forces above even the capture of the town of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. And then Gerasimov turns his attention to the other place where he says an encirclement is taking place. Second, Kupiansk is encircled in the direction of operations of Group of Forces West. Assault units of the 68th Motorized Rifle Division of the 6th Army have executed a flanking maneuver and captured enemy crossings over the Oskol River south of the city. They have blocked Ukrainian troops on the left bank east of Kupiansk in cooperation with the 47th Motorized Rifle Division, the 27th Motorized Rifle Brigade, the 1st Tank Army. Units of the enemy's 14th, 43rd and 116th Mechanized Brigades, as well as the 1st Brigade of the Ukrainian National Guard, 18 combat battalions in total, are encircled. Now, on the face of it, 18 battalions in Kupiansk, Ukrainian battalions encircled in Kupiansk, might suggest a significantly smaller group encircled than the one in Pokrovsk. But Peskov says that the total number of Ukrainian troops encircled in the Kupiansk area numbers around 5,000. Again, let me reiterate, I am not there. I am not counting Ukrainian soldiers encircled. I don't know whether Peskov is correct. Presumably, these numbers were provided to Putin by Gerasimov, which is how Peskov knows them. But it's worth pointing out, perhaps, that Gerasimov does not provide any numbers at all in the published comments of his words that the Kremlin has provided. So one must assume that Peskov knows, or believes he knows, what he's saying. It's not impossible that the Russians have got their numbers wrong. It's not impossible that the Russians are inflating the numbers of Ukrainian troops encircled. But perhaps the most important thing to say is that the Russians are saying that the Ukrainian troops in Kupiansk, just like the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, are encircled. Now, to those of you who've been following these programs, none of this will come as any kind of surprise. I have been talking for some time about how it looked increasingly as if the Russians were gradually encircling and trapping the Ukrainian garrisons in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd on the one hand, and Kupiansk on the other. In the case of the Battle of Kupiansk, the encirclement, the centre of the encirclement, is in the Ukrainian positions, the Ukrainian positions that still exist east of the Oskol River in Kupiansk's industrial district. The western part of Kupiansk, which is, by the way, on higher ground, and which is the residential part of Kupiansk, which is on the west bank of the Oskol River, I believe came under complete Russian control sometime over the course of the last week. And Gerasimov seems to be confirming precisely that. He says that the Russians have conducted a flanking maneuver, that they've captured the river crossings, and that they have blocked the Ukrainian armed forces on the left bank east of Kupiansk. In other words, on the left bank of the Oskol River. So, Gerasimov's report is exactly in line with the commentary that I've been providing on this channel and which we have been providing on the Duran. Now, of course, the Ukrainians have been telling different things, but I noticed some days ago, and I discussed this in a previous program, that there was an account in the Daily Telegraph about the situation in Pokrovsk, which appeared to focus mostly on alleged Russian war crimes in the town, but which, if you read the article carefully, appeared to prepare the British readership for the fact that Pokrovsk was about to fall. And yesterday, an article appeared in The Guardian, another British newspaper. You can still find it there in The Guardian, it's still up, which also seemed to prepare British readers for the fact that Kupiansk was also likely to fall before very long. The Guardian article about Kupiansk seems to describe the situation in Kupiansk quite accurately if one were to take a time machine and go back in time by a couple of months. It implies that the Russians have just crossed the Oskol River and arrived on the West Bank. And it talks about successful Ukrainian resistance in Kupiansk itself. And it revives the story about the Russians infiltrating Kupiansk through gas pipes. In reality, and I don't think this is disputed by any commentator who's been following the war closely, be it on the Russian or on the Ukrainian side. Anyway, in reality, the Russians, of course, crossed the Oskol River long ago, many, many months ago. I'm not able to remember exactly when, but as I said, they crossed the Oskol River quite a long time ago, captured various towns and positions to the north of Kupiansk, gradually started to occupy ground southwards towards Kupiansk. Then eventually they entered Kupiansk. And as I've discussed in recent programs, they've captured the whole of the residential area of western Kupiansk. But anyway, whatever. The article in The Guardian also seems to be an attempt to prepare British readers for the fact that Kupiansk is about to fall, even though it implies that the Ukrainians are still holding their positions there. Now, there's been some further corroboration of what Gerasimov himself has been saying, because General Sirsky, the Ukrainian military commander, has apparently also come to the area and is meeting there with Ukrainian commanders. And there are reports, I've seen them on the Russian side of the internet so far, not on the Ukrainian side, but I presume these comments have been reported in Ukraine, where the Russians have seen them. Anyway, Sirsky apparently has warned Ukrainian commanders in the Pokrovsk area not to provide over-optimistic reports about the situation, not to deceive the command by making it appear that the situation is better than it really is, not to lie. And anyway, presumably he's trying to work out a plan to deal with this crisis that Gerasimov is talking about. I have to say, and I'm going to say this straight away, this is true. Syrsky has indeed lectured Ukrainian unit commanders in that kind of way. Then, frankly, I think one of the people he should be looking at in order to, should be reading his lecture to is himself. He should be reading this lecture to his own reflection in a mirror. Because it seems to me that one of the regular practices that General Syrsky has engaged in ever since he became Ukraine's military chief in place of General Zelensky is that he has repeatedly provided ridiculously over-optimistic assessments of the state of the battle. To give one example, which I will never forget, he was saying right up to the moment of the fall of Suja in Kursk region in March that the situation in Suja was fully under control, even as that town was in the process of falling to and being recaptured by the Russians. So I cannot believe that Syrsky is not much better informed about the military situation than he actually pretends. And frankly, to me, these latest lectures, on the assumption that they have been made, and by the way, I ought to say I have little doubt that they have been made, these latest lectures are a clear, transparent attempt to transfer responsibility from himself onto lower-ranking commanders, and well, they are totally unbecoming of a military commander in chief. By the way, and just briefly, the fact that Syrsky is now talking about people lying does make me wonder what he has been telling Zelensky, whether he has been giving Zelensky a completely false view of the battle as well. If so, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. Anyway, there it is. Now, the meeting did not end. The meeting between Gerasimov and Putin did not end with these reports because Gerasimov also touched on the situation in other places, and he had this to say: formations of military units, a group of forces west, continue to successfully advance in the Liman direction, with Yampol almost completely liberated. There is dispute about this on the Ukrainian side. They are claiming that there is still fighting going on in Yampol and that the Russians have captured the center of the village of Yampol, but not yet its southern positions in the south. And then he goes on to say, this is what Gerasimov says, offensive operations are also underway in other directions. Over the past 2 weeks, group of forces north has successfully advanced in the southern part of Volchansk, with more than 70% of the city liberated to date. Now, other reports actually put the percentage of Volchansk liberated by the Russian army higher. Well, you can take this as you will. Let's stick with the 70%. Assault units, a group of assault forces south, have liberated Dronovka. That's the village west of Siversk. That has been universally confirmed and acknowledged. And Plushevka, which is close to Konstantinovka. And continue urban warfare in Siversk and Konstantinovka. Now, Gerasimov has been saying for some weeks that there is ongoing fighting within the town limits of both Konstantinovka and Siversk. About Konstantinovka, there is now no longer any doubt. The Ukrainians have released drone footage which shows drone attacks on Russian soldiers well inside the city limits, well inside the residential area of Konstantinivka itself. This has led, by the way, to some Russian telegram channels claiming that Konstantinivka is in the process of being stormed. I would say, perhaps more objectively, that there are heavy urban battles going on inside Konstantinivka. There's intense street fighting going on there. And that, of course, is what Gerasimov is saying. Now, Gerasimov says there's also street fighting going on in Seversk. So far, no one else has confirmed that. There's been no confirmation of that from any other military source on the Russian side. And, of course, it is categorically denied by the Ukrainian side. But as we see, what Gerasimov has recently taken to saying has invariably up to now come out true, except that perhaps sometimes he is reporting things ahead of events. And perhaps that's what he's doing in Seversk. And then he finishes, he says that units of Group of Forces East are advancing in Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporozhye regions with six villages liberated, of which, of course, one is Poltavka. I'm not going to discuss that battle now in this program. Another is perhaps Malaya Tokmachka, a village located just to the southeast of Orekhov. Again, I'm not going to discuss that battle in this program. Notice that in this report, Gerasimov says absolutely nothing about any fighting taking place in Kherson, in Kherson region, in the city of Kherson, of any operation being conducted by the Russian military across the Dnieper, of the Russians recapturing islands in the Dnieper and landing troops in the southern parts of the city of Kherson or anything like that. The Russians, and this must be intentional, have cast a curtain of silence down over whatever type of battle is taking place in Kherson, in the city of Kherson, which makes it all but impossible to make much sense of what is actually going on there. Anyway, Gerasimov's report was, of course, listened to by Putin, and we are told that Putin then went on to hear reports from the individual unit commanders of the Russian army who are participating in this operation. And Putin then congratulated all the various soldiers who had been participating in the battle. He then went on to say that extensive and challenging efforts have to be made in order to eliminate the encircled enemy formations. I would like to draw your attention to several points. In order to minimize avoidable human losses, I ask that you take all possible measures to secure the surrender of Ukrainian troops, those who wish to lay down arms. We are aware that it is not easy for them. And then he goes into explanations of how the Ukrainian military has a habit of taking active measures against any Ukrainian troops who do seek to surrender. But he goes on to say that our actions are only natural. We must act and treat prisoners in accordance with international law and the laws of the Russian Federation. Historically, the Russian army has shown mercy to a defeated foe, and we will act in that tradition. Well, some might take issue with some of that, but anyway, that's what he said. And he says that The Ukrainians must, therefore, be given every option to surrender. Now, important, these words are, again, important, because once more we see that this time the Russian objective is to destroy these forces, to destroy the forces in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, and the forces in Kupiansk. There is no question this time of them being allowed to retreat, however difficult and disastrous that defeat would be. This time it's like Mariupol in 2022, when the Ukrainians are given no choice but basically to surrender or die. And one could argue that it takes us back to some of the things that used to happen in the Second World War. Stalingrad, for example. And by the way, we are now at the period when the Battle of Stalingrad in Russia tends to get commemorated. Though it is essential at this point to say that there is a massive difference in scale. We are not looking at battles in Pokrovsk or Kupiansk that bear any resemblance in scale terms to the one that were fought in Stalingrad. But the point is, again, that Putin wants these Ukrainian military units this time destroyed. The Russians are not just seeking to capture Kupiansk and Pokrovsk. They are seeking to destroy the military, Ukrainian military units that are defending these places. And Putin then goes on to say that every effort must be made to protect the civilian population. He makes the usual Russian accusation, which, by the way, has, in my opinion, a strong measure of truth behind it, that the Ukrainians have been hiding behind civilians. He uses the loaded expressions, human shields. I'm not saying it is an inaccurate one. And then he stresses that commanders must continue to carry out the special military operation according to the plan developed by the general staff. So again, an admission by the Russians that there is an overall plan, that the Russian military in the area of the special military operation is working to a carefully drawn out and prepared plan, that this plan is being executed. I discussed about two weeks ago, an article by Marat Khairulin, which I saw on his Substack blog, which appeared in March of this year, and which appeared to be remarkably prescient about some of the moves that the Russians would take in the months between March and now. I said that this provided further evidence that there is clearly a Russian plan and that the Russians are working according to that plan. And by the way, according to the timetable set out in that plan, just saying. And here we have Putin again, formally confirming, semi-officially confirming, that there is indeed a plan, that the general staff of the Russian armed forces has drawn it up, and that the Russian military is executing it. This is an important, in my opinion, this is an important point to understand. One constantly hears criticism of the supposedly slow pace of the military operation, the special military operation. There's endless assumptions or presumptions that this is Putin's doing, that Putin is somehow holding back the Russian military from advancing faster. Well, I think the evidence is now clear that the Russian army is advancing at the pace which it is, because that is the plan. It is advancing according to the plan which the Russian military itself, the general staff, in other words, have drawn up. If you feel, and I know some people do, that the Russians are advancing more slowly than they should, then blame the Russian military, not Vladimir Putin. Blame the Russian high command. In practice, I think that these criticisms are misplaced, because Putin, immediately after his comments confirming the existence of the plan, explains why the war has been fought in this methodical and incremental way. The lives of our military personnel remain the priority. We discuss this on a constant basis. You know my approach and I know yours. We will not tie operations to specific dates or events. We will proceed from military expediency and place the safety of our fighters, our soldiers, first and foremost. So there is a plan, there is a timetable, but at no point will the Russians act in a way that throws away unnecessarily the lives of their troops. They will always act methodically and carefully. Now, again, these words would probably astonish many people in the West, because we have been hearing for 3-4 years now about the massive losses the Russian army has experienced. We've had comments about Russian human wave tactics. This has been commonly said in the past, especially, as I remember, during the fighting in Bakhmut. We've had comments about the Russians using sometimes infiltration tactics and at all times operating without any regard to human lives. And here we see Putin himself saying that, on the contrary, the military operations must be conducted in a way that limits casualties, and that this is his priority and the military's priority also. Now, again, undoubtedly, this does have an influence on the pace of military operations. The Russians assembled enormous armies, threw them into the battle, set out to capture a place like Pokrovsk without regard to losses. No doubt they would be able to capture Pokrovsk, probably would have done so by now, way back in August. But the losses would have been very, very high, and they would have accumulated, and this would have had an impact not just on opinion inside Russia itself, but I am going to suggest on the morale of the army also. One of the reasons why the Russian military has been adapting and progressing, improving constantly in the battle, why there is no significant problem of desertion on the Russian side, why morale has remained steady throughout the special military operation, is, I am sure, because the Russian soldiers who are fighting are confident that their commander-in-chief and their leadership, their military leadership, is not throwing away their lives in pointless attacks or in attacks that are supposed to answer to some arbitrary timetable, or which are timed for to correspond to some political event. And that, it seems to me, is the way that you would expect professionals to conduct an operation like this, which, to say again, is a special military operation. It is not a global war in the way that the Second World War was a global war. And, well, the one thing one has to say about Putin and about Gerasimov and all of the other people involved on the Russian side is that they are all professionals, professionals to their fingertips. Anyway, there it is. So that is what we see in this report. The Ukrainians, for the first time in this war, are surrounded simultaneously in two places, in Pokrovsk and in Kupiansk. And as I discussed, as I've discussed in several of my recent programs, it seems to me that a similar encirclement is almost certainly going to develop at some point over the next couple of days or weeks in Siversk as well, following the fall of Dronivka, the village of Dronivka, and if Gerasimov is right, the imminent fall of the village of Yampol to the west of Siversk, the supply routes to Siversk are going to be cut, and the Ukrainian garrison in Siversk is going to find itself marooned in territory located far to the east of Ukrainian defence lines in other places. There are still some possible lines of retreat for these Ukrainian troops to take, even after the roads have been closed. They can still, in theory, retreat across the fields to some villages located some distance from Siversk across the open fields. It would be a horrific retreat, but perhaps if it were to be ordered today, it could be done. But I think the time to do that is quickly ending, and I suspect that in a week or so, the trap around the Ukrainian troops in Siversk also will have been closed shut. Now, I said earlier in this program that the pace of the Russian offensive is quickening, and I hold to that. This is, of course, again, completely contrary to the narrative stream you read in the West. In the West, on the contrary, the Russian offensive this summer and autumn has been a failure. The Russians supposedly have made little progress. An article by Seymour Hersh says as much, but there's been many other articles making the same claim. The British Defence Ministry says this. Donald Trump said this a couple of weeks ago in a True Social post. In my opinion, all of those claims are completely wrong. They misunderstand the nature of the battle. As it happens, the very latest reports by those who study these things suggest that over the last couple of weeks, the Russians have, in fact, captured rather more territory than they were capturing in the weeks just before, though still less than at the highest point of tempo of their advance, which was in the summer. But square kilometres captured is, in my opinion, a completely false metric to understand the pace, the true pace of an advance. We are talking about an ongoing attack on major fortified positions. And the metric that should be applied instead is the speed with which these particular fortified positions are falling, the speed at which the Russians are capturing them. Now, I would have thought that was obvious, but of course it is not what you ever read in the West. Pokrovsk, to repeat again, I've said this many times, was assaulted seriously for the first time in August. Perhaps the first battles began in late July, but the major assault took place in August. Certainly not 15 months ago, as I've seen many people claim. And since then, over the space of a couple of weeks, we've seen most of Pokrovsk, I think that is probably accurate now, fall under Russian control. And according to Gerasimov, the Ukrainian garrison in Pokrovsk and nearby Mirnograd encircled. The Battle of Kupiansk has taken longer, but the Russian forces there, I suspect, are fewer. And of course, there's been the complicating factor of the Oskol River. The point is that over the last couple of weeks, in Kupiansk as well, we see a sizable Ukrainian force encircled too and left in desperate straits east of the Oskol River. In Siversk too, a Ukrainian force is on the brink of encirclement, and various reports, including from the Ukrainians themselves, speak of a developing crisis in the nearby town of Liman, which is about twice the size of Siversk. This points to an accelerating, intensifying tempo of operations. Once these places all start to fall, and judging from what Gerasimov is saying, they're going to fall fairly soon, then it will be impossible, or so it seems to me, to deny this fact for very much longer. Now, Putin did say one other thing over the course of these comments. He also said that the Ukrainians were certain to try to do things to try to break out of the encirclements. And he said that the Russians needed to take steps to make sure that when the Ukrainian counterattacks took place, that these counterattacks were repelled. And that obviously is true. That is exactly correct. We will undoubtedly see Ukrainian counterattacks attempting to unblock these encircled formations. I said that Sirsky has arrived in this area. There are reports at the moment that there is a Ukrainian counterattack underway in northeast, in the area of the Russian breakthrough, northeast of Pokrovsk. Though I ought to say that there are also reports in that very same area that the important village of Sharkovo, in that very same earlier area, is about to be captured by the Russians. I am sure that the Russians are going to be able to parry these counterattacks, and they will do everything they can, doubtless, to deploy whatever troops and drones and bombers and those kind of things are needed in order to do that. Now, all of this is very dramatic, and as I said, at the end of the day, despite the progress the Russians are making in the sky, which I've discussed in several places, it is always the situation on the ground which inevitably gathers the greater attention. But one should nonetheless say a few more things about the situation in the sky. The Russians are currently deploying for the first time the new precision-guided fab bombs. They're not actually new. They're old fab bombs, mostly, which have been converted. But the Russians do seem to have an immense inventory of these bombs. And apparently they have a production line that can go on producing them in prodigious quantities. There's no sign of any shortage on the Russian side in operating these bombs. Anyway, the Russians have adapted these bombs into precision-guided bombs, but they've also now have a means of adding a jet engine to some of these bombs. Photos of these precision-guided bombs with a jet engine have now appeared. I had assumed earlier that, you know, it might be some kind of simple jet. It looks a little bit more sophisticated than that, which slightly surprises me because obviously that will push up the cost. Perhaps the jet engine is an adaptation of the same jet engine that is used on the Garand 3 jet-powered drone, just saying. But anyway, what it means is that the Russian Air Force, the Sukhoi 34 bombers, are now able to conduct airstrikes using heavy bombs on Ukrainian positions hundreds of kilometers away. And that means that the reach of the Russian Air Force has reached, it now extends far further behind the Ukrainian front lines. Now, this is important because though the missiles and the drones do carry a significant punch, bombs carry a far greater one. The amount of explosive a bomb carries is multiple times, in some cases, orders of magnitude greater than what one sees in a drone, a Garand drone, or even a missile. And, well, obviously, if the Russians start deploying bombs in this way to conduct deep strikes inside Ukraine, precision-guided deep strikes inside Ukraine, then this is going to be a major crisis for the Ukrainians as well. And there is another piece of tantalizing news which has sent a lot of puzzlement and a frisson of excitement both on the Russian side of the internet and on the Ukrainian side of the internet, which is that the Russian Air Force has also apparently begun to receive the first batches out of an order of 32 of some new cruise missile. Now, nobody seems to know exactly what this cruise missile is, whether it's subsonic, supersonic, or hypersonic, whether it is possibly a air-launched version of the Tsarkon missile, the Tsarkon hypersonic missile, for example, which is itself a missile launched by Russian Navy ships, or whether it is a heavily stealthy subsonic missile. Nobody quite knows, but there is a lot of excitement and in some cases alarm about this particular missile and uncertainty as to what it is going to do. And as to that, well, we will have to wait and see. Meanwhile, just to say, elsewhere, on other topics, Gerasimov also advised Putin about a major exercise that the Russians carried out of their strategic nuclear forces, which Putin himself presided over a couple of days ago. I did not discuss this exercise in earlier programs because these exercises that the Russians regularly conduct are routine affairs, and there is no reason to think that this particular exercise was timed for anything relating to the latest political or diplomatic news. Certainly it was not timed in connection with the debacle of the US-Russia summit or anything of that kind. So let's put all that aside, all the new sanctions or anything of that kind. But at roughly the same time that this exercise was underway, the Russians did test their latest nuclear-powered cruise missile, and Gerasimov did provide a brief report about this to Putin. And Putin asked him to provide information, and this is what Gerasimov said. Dear Supreme Commander-in-Chief, a test was conducted on October 21st. Unlike previous trials, this one featured a many-hour flight with the missile covering 14,000 kilometers, and that is not the limit. And then Putin responded, it is nuclear-powered, right? And Gerasimov said, it is indeed, it uses nuclear propulsion. Burevestnik, that is the name of this missile, Burevestnik's technical characteristics generally allow for its use with assured accuracy against highly protected targets at any range. During the flight, the missile completed all prescribed vertical and horizontal maneuvers, showcasing a high capability to evade missile defense and air defense systems. And then Putin responded, how long was it in the air? And Gerasimov said, about 15 hours. And then Putin asked, and that is not the limit. And Gerasimov said, no, it is not. And then Putin responded, Mr. Gerasimov, we need to determine which class of weapons this new system belongs to. That's a rather extraordinary comment. I mean, is it a strategic missile? Or is it a tactical missile? What is it exactly? Identify possible modes of employment and begin preparing the infrastructure to base it in our armed forces. And Gerasimov said affirmative. So if you take these words at face value, which, by the way, I don't, the Russians have developed an exceptionally long-range nuclear-powered cruise missile with the ability to conduct complex evading manoeuvres without deciding what they're going to actually need it for or what tasks it is supposed to execute. I don't believe a word of that. And I don't think anybody who's watching this program is going to do so either. But anyway, what Putin and Gerasimov were, of course, engaging in was in a performance. They obviously know all about the test. The purpose of this exchange was to highlight to the media, to the Russian people, that this nuclear-powered cruise missile that has been talked about a great deal in Russia since Putin first announced plans for its development back in 2018, that this nuclear-powered cruise missile has now completed its testing, that its development process is now ended, and that it is about to enter service and serial production. And they're giving us some clue as to the kind of weapon it is. Now, note that it has essentially unlimited range. It appears that it flew mostly over a test site. So it was circling around over this test site for 15 hours, executing all kinds of exceptionally complex maneuvers. So this is a maneuverable missile, and it can loiter. So what that means is that in a period of international tension, the Russians could, in theory, launch these nuclear-powered cruise missiles. They could operate for hours over maybe the Arctic Ocean, maybe the Atlantic, maybe the Pacific. It might not be easy to locate where they are. There's no very clear photographs of this missile so far, but it does seem that it might be quite stealthy, so it might be rather difficult for the United States to track, just to say. And anyway, these things could be out there in the sky, waiting for hours, many hours, for a command from Moscow before either proceeding to their targets or presumably returning to Russia if that was the command instead. And, well, apparently these missiles are also going to be equipped with nuclear warheads. Now, I find development of this system extremely concerning. Like the other rather similar system, the Poseidon underwater drone, once upon a time, I would have strongly opposed developments of weapon systems like this. I would have said that they are deeply destabilizing, that at a time of international tension, their very existence is likely to increase tension and fear to stratospheric levels. But, well, we've seen the collapse of arms control that has taken place in the last 30 years since the United States pulled out first from the ABM Treaty and then from all of the other treaties that the Soviet Union and the United States had concluded with each other. We see that the New START Treaty is almost on the brink of complete collapse. Unless it is extended in February, there will be no system of arms control in existence. And, well, I have to say it. I think that the development by the Russians of all of these new systems, the Poseidon submarine drone, the Sarmat, exceptionally powerful intercontinental ballistic missile, and now the Burevestnik, the Burevestnik nuclear-powered cruise missile, are all a direct product of this complete collapse in arms control. And I would make the further point that the Russians, who did not initiate these various steps to tear up the arms control treaties, seem to be moving, well, quite aggressively, actually, to develop these new weapons. Whereas the United States, which, by contrast, was the party that took the initiative to start scrapping the treaties, has basically trod water in that very same time. I'm not saying that there haven't been significant upgrades in the American air defences and nuclear forces over the last 25 years. Obviously, there have been. But it seems to me, nonetheless remain the case that the big advances so far have been taken by the Russians. The Burevestnik, the Poseidon submarine drone, the Oreshnik system, which is, of course, a conventional system, the Sarmat missile, who knows what others. Anyway, there it is. One would like to think that sanity, or at least concern, would start to develop around these systems in the United States, and that somebody would want to talk about these systems with the Russians. But for the moment, there is little sign of this. Now, to conclude on the military things, the Russians also conducted another massive strike on Ukraine, air, missile and drone strike on Ukraine last night. There is an article in the New York Times which acknowledges that there is now a high probability that Ukraine is going to experience prolonged periods of blackout. We've been spending a huge amount of time recently talking about the diplomacy, whether there would be a meeting between Putin and Trump. We've been talking about the latest sanctions that the United States has imposed. We've talked about the agonizing in Europe about whether or not to seize the frozen Russian assets. But it's important to remember that it remains ultimately a war, and in a war, it is he who wins on the battlefield who ultimately decides the outcome. And the Russians are winning the war where it matters most, which is on the battlefield. They are in the process of encircling the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk and before long Siversk. They are the ones who are advancing in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions and who have perhaps crossed the Dnieper. It is they who are battering Ukraine every night now and are destroying its electric power generation systems and are creating a crisis in Ukraine, the result of which I don't want to even try to imagine for the people who live in Ukraine. We talk in the West about forcing the Russians to the negotiating table. This is always the euphemism that is used for trying to get the Russians to stop the sanctions that the United States has just imposed have been quite clearly explained as being intended to get the Russians to stop on the existing front lines. But the Russians are showing no sign of wanting to do any such thing. There is no discussion in these exchanges between Putin and Gerasimov about diplomacy. Putin tells Gerasimov, he actually says this, we're not determining our military operations according to any events or timetables except the events on the ground. So don't concern yourself with the diplomacy. That is entirely my business. Focus instead on the war. And Putin is showing no sign. The Russians are showing no sign, despite all of the attempted pressures that the West is trying to place upon them. They're showing no sign that on the Ukrainian battlefields they intend to stop. So, if pressure of that kind, diplomatic, political, economic pressure, is not going to cause the Russians to stop, the Russians are going to win the war. Now that ought to be obvious. It ought to be becoming more obvious every day. But it is a remarkable, indeed extraordinary fact that in the West, this reality is simply not being acknowledged. The reason, of course, is that we're hearing so many, well, I think entirely untrue things, that Russia is suffering losses 5 times greater than Ukraine. That was said by Edward Luce in the Financial Times a few days ago. Again, he cannot have any figures that corroborate this, that are verified, because such figures don't exist. I believe I know what Ukrainian casualties are, at least, as of the 1st of August of this year, though I've already explained in previous programmes that because of the source of that information that I was provided, I don't believe I can share it. What I will say, and I've said this already, is that the figure is eye-wateringly huge. I don't know the size of Russian losses, but the only survey that makes any attempt to assess them scientifically, which is the Media Zona survey, doesn't come anywhere close to matching the figures that people like Edward Luce and Donald Trump and all kinds of others have been bandying around. Given that Media Zona is operated by people who are extremely hostile to the Russian government, I cannot imagine that they would not have reported these huge numbers if they had actually existed. In fact, and as I have pointed out in various programmes, perhaps because they have been concerned about the discrepancy between the actual figures that they are reporting and the claims that the Ukrainians and Western governments have been making, they seem to me to have watered down their methodology. And even then, they can't come anywhere close to arriving at any of the kind of numbers that governments in the West and commentators in the West are constantly repeating. Well, if the situation on the battlefronts is not going to cause the Russians to stop, if they're not suffering these enormous losses that people in the West imagine, if the Russians are much closer to a breakthrough than the official narrative in the West says, and if, as I firmly believe, these latest sanctions that the United States has imposed are not going to move the dial on the Russian economy to any significant extent at all, then, well, where is the plan? How do you get the Russians to stop unless you do so by discussing with the Russians the root causes of the war? In other words, those things that concern them. We continue to behave in the West as if we are in a position of advantage or in a position of strength over the Russians, when the very fact that we are constantly looking for leverage, more sanctions, more talk about weapon supplies, reckless talk about missile strikes into Russia, that kind of thing, shows us that leverage is the one thing we simply do not have, and that we do not have a position of strength over the Russians. Now, I'm going to conclude this programme at this point. I will say that there's been more flickers of signs that some people in Russia are unhappy about Kirill Dmitriev's trip to the United States. Peskov has given what is essentially a rather defensive interview with Pavel Zarubin about it. I'm going to return to that in my programme tomorrow. Despite various claims about India reducing purchases of Russian oil, there's been no statement to that effect that I'm aware of by any Indian official. And whilst Prime Minister Modi of India has avoided meeting President Trump by staying away from the ASEAN summit meeting in Malaysia, I understand that the word in India is that Putin's visit to India in December is still on. If that visit does take place, then I think we can take it as a fairly strong sign that perhaps after a period of adjustment, India does intend to resume buying Russian oil fairly quickly and might not even be reducing its purchases of Russian oil by anything like the ex like to anything like the extent that some people in the West want to believe. But all of this is preliminary, and we will see. And as I said, there's no word so far that Putin's visit to India is proceeding, or is going to go ahead. No word that it's been called off. The Indian government is remaining very, very silent, very quiet about this whole business. Though there are some indications from certain comments that the Indian Commerce Minister, Mr. Goyal, has made that India might be rethinking its plans to try to negotiate a trade agreement with the United States. Anyway, all of this to be discussed in much more detail later. Now, President Trump is due to meet President Xi Jinping of China soon at the APEC summit meeting in South Korea. In advance of that, there have been meetings between Chinese and American trade negotiators in Malaysia. The Americans have put a very optimistic spin on the outcome of the discussions. Chinese reports have been much more measured. The very first report that the Chinese published was that the talks had been candid. Now, candid suggests that the Chinese had set the record straight with the Americans on certain matters. And, well, it could be construed as suggesting that the meeting was, in fact, somewhat contentious. Just saying. The Chinese then did publish a rather more detailed account of the meeting, which spoke about work being done to agree the parameters of the forthcoming meeting between Trump and Xi. Again, it was all very, very carefully worded and far from fulsome. And I don't get the impression, briefly, reading the Chinese accounts, that they're as optimistic about the progress of these discussions as the Americans are. Anyway, we will see. No doubt that will all become clear over the next couple of days. And lastly, President Trump has been going around saying that he will have his meeting with Putin when he's confident that there will be a deal, which is actually very rich coming from him, given that it was he who 10 days ago proposed the Budapest meeting, even though there was no sign of any deal at that time, and then abruptly called it off. So, again, I find that a bit strange. And I would also say something further, which is that it's deeply uncomfortable for his friend, Viktor Orban, who, as Alex and I on the Duran have pointed out, must feel that Trump has thrown him under a bus. And of course, Orban now, as he's been apparently trying to get the Americans to understand, has to worry about the fact that following the American sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil, he might have problems. His refineries might have problems buying and refining Russian oil. And it looks as if he is trying to get the Americans to provide a carve-out as well. And of course, lurking in the background, we have the affair with Venezuela, the attack on Venezuela, perhaps more accurately, on the horizon as well. But these are the topics I'm going to discuss, as I said, in my next program or over the course of my next programs. This is the point where I'm going to finish today. So let me remind you again you can remind you again to check out our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. And also, by the way, our new Substack page, our new Substack site. Also, please don't forget to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. And last but not least, please remember to check out also our shop. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.